Welcome to Pulp Tales, fascinating stories of the pulp magazines and the creative minds that brought them to life. The fictioneers, the artists, the editors, and others. Brought to you by the PulpNet. Learn more about the pulp magazines through articles, blogs, bibliographies, links, over 100 episodes of this podcast, and much more at the PulpNet. Your link to the pulp magazines for almost 30 years.
I've always think there's something weird about Dad's women, too, that is unusual compared to the women that appear in other pulp magazines. They just seem a little more empowered in a world in which violence is around them, rather than completely looking like damsels in distress. Almost no one else was ever doing that in the spicy world.
In this episode of Pulp Tales, artist and pulp historian David Saunders discusses eight artists: Adolf Barreau, Harry L. Parkhurst, Delos Palmer, William F. Soar, Norman Saunders, Hugh J. Ward, Alan Anderson, and Joseph Socoli, who painted covers and drew illustrations for the spicy pulps. David is Norman Saunders' son and proprietor of the website pulpartists.com, a field guide to wild American pulp artists. This Pulp Tales was recorded at Pulp Fest 2024 in Pittsburgh on Thursday, August 1st, 2024.
Thanks, everyone, for coming to hear about the spicy mystery artists. You know, there's too many artists that work for the spicies for us to look at in this time period. So I'm just going to be doing the eight that are listed up there, which are my favorite. But they're also the ones I think that had the biggest impact on the genre. And we're going to be looking at them like what I think of as kind of chronologically of when they were sort of dominant in the market. But before we start, I do want to warn you that there are many images that are intentionally shocking, offensive, and degrading to women. So the first one we're looking at is Adolf Barreau. I really like his work. He has this, they're very adorable looking little cartoony drawings that are loosely based on the popular John Hell Jr., who is the Jazz Age cartoonist, who's extremely trendy, you know, in the 1920s. And so he just seemed to capitalize on that. Adolf Barreau was born Adolf Gripon in 1899 in Charleston, South Carolina. He's African-American. His father, George Gripon, was born in 1870, and his mother, Georgiana Little, was born in 1873. His father worked as a wheelwright, and they married and had two kids. Now, Charleston is a hot and humid port town, and in those days, the foreign ships brought a lot of stuff, including malaria, smallpox, yellow fever, and typhoid. So 10 months after Adolf was born, his father died of typhoid fever at the age of 29. His mother supported the family by working as a seamstress, and by age 12, Adolf had caught typhoid and had to spend 3 years recuperating in bed. And during that time, he became an avid reader and really interested in making art. Those kind of things you could do as a kid when you're in bed. When he was about 15, he had regained his health enough, and the doctor said that he should leave the humid environment. He went to live with some aunts in New York City. And when he was there, he changed his name from Gripon to Barreau, which was his actual middle name. He attended DeWitt Clinton High School, which is a very good high school in New York City, like a, you know, merit type high school. You have to have good grades and stuff. And he became the editor of the school newspaper. After graduating, he worked that summer at the J. Walter Thompson, which was the most famous advertising agency in America. I think that really had a massive impact on him creatively. He actually entered Yale University, which some of our favorite pulp critics here in the audience have attended. And he was in the School of Art, and he studied there for 3 years. But before completing his final year, he left Yale and moved back to New York City to start his career as an advertising artist. In New York City, he joined an art social club. It was called the Kit Kat Club. And the artists, you know, it was like a fraternity kind of thing. It was very fraternal, I should say. And they would all pitch in a little bit of dues, and they would have life class every evening. And so they had, like maybe a dozen models that were posed for them routinely. To save money, they could all draw from the model, so you didn't have to hire the model yourself and pay them a couple dollars an hour. So by all working together as a club, they could go whatever night they wanted and could draw from the model. And they also bought a keg of beer collectively, and so you could drink beer and draw the model, so what could be better? And once a year, to raise extra money, they had an event that people could come to that was just fun. And they would stage these silly skits with handmade stage sets and things. And they wrote them themselves, and the artists will do it. And so it was like this thing called the Artists and Models Ball. And it was an annual event, and they would sell tickets and junk, and then that would help, keep the Kit Kat Club going. Rube Goldberg, who made the funny inventions, was one of the members, and James Montgomery Flagg, who did the painting of Uncle Sam saying, "I want you," was another famous member. In 1923, the year after Adolph Barrow joined, the police raided the joint, and it became really infamous that they were having these parties with naked women, but it was actually just their models that they were all friendly with and was part of the community, so to speak. But then the following year, when they had the show, people started writing in and asking for tickets for this thing. And they wound up getting so many tens of thousands of tickets to this little show that they were doing that they had to rent the theater next to the Ziegfeld Follies Theater on Broadway in Times Square. And it was a gigantic hit, and it was called the Artists and Models Ball. You may know that right around that time, 1923 and then 24 and 25, there were all these magazines made that were nudie pictures of women, but also stories about Titian or something, and they would show pictures of great statues by Canova or something. And so it was like half arty and half pinup-y. And they were all called things like the Artist Ball, Artists and Models, Art Lovers Magazine, French Follies, the Paris at Midnight. And it was all connotations that were stuff they could sell, because they knew that there were thousands of people in the Times Square area that would like a souvenir of that sort of thing. And so the magazines themselves became really extremely successful as a whole new genre. And one of the publishers of those things was Harry Donenfeld. And so Donenfeld had been working producing racing forms and tip sheets for Frank Costello, the mafia guy who controlled all gambling in New York. And they also needed to have a printing outfit that could print all this stuff. And so they tapped Donenfeld, who was a salesman working for that company, to be like the titular head of this so-called publishing company. But it was really just a fly-by-night thing to print up these sleazy magazines that were trying to capitalize on the popularity. When they formed those magazines, they hired Adolph Barrow, who was working at the Kit Kat Club and was part of the whole deal, to illustrate the magazines. And they hired some of the other artists that were there, Worth Carnahan also. At that same time on Broadway, the most popular show of all popular shows was called Make It Snappy. And that was by Eddie Cantor singing, "Yes, We Have No Bananas," and "I Am the Sheik of Araby," and both of those have sexual double entendres in them at the time. And so this was, again, this very spicy connotations of Make It Snappy. So then Donenfeld put out Snappy Stories also to capitalize on that same thing, same time, same place, same publisher, same distributor. And they were sold in primarily newsstands in the Midtown area. But they found out they did okay. And so this was the beginning of the concept of the, Snappy comes from the idea sort of a ginger snap. And so they also put out ginger and pepper pot and red pepper, red devil, pep. Those were the beginning of the sort of exploitative business of trying to sell people, which were little sort of pulps that were more like program brochures that you would get at the actual theater or something. These risque pulps were produced by a group that was of publishers that were under contract to the distributor of Eastern Distribution, which was co-owned by Paul Sampliner. I don't know if you guys are into comics, but that was eventually the owner with Harry Donenfeld of DC Comics. Paul Sampliner actually was a representative of, he was a businessman in the Prohibition era organized crime in New York City. So he was actually a money man in the mafia under Frank Costello. Donenfeld went on to do all of the so-called spicy pulps, and Barreau became then his director for all the spicy pulps. So he was the art director, not just for Snappy and Ginger and stuff, but then for the actual spices themselves. And one of the things that had kept happening was that they, the distributor would sort of renege on stuff and screw people intentionally, because the people that were actually under contract to the distributor. So that was actually a sort of a corrupt system. But what wound up happening is that a lot of the artists and writers wouldn't get paid. And so they were stiffed because bankruptcy could be declared and they could reform the company and then just keep going. So that was a simple way for the organized crime to do things. But the problem was that you had to go back to the same group of talented people and say a month later, oh, now I'm doing a new magazine. Yeah, it's the same title, different publisher, you know, it's all very different. Sorry about that. Could you work again for us? And a lot of the talent would say, go to hell. And so they realized they needed to develop a sort of intermediary. And so they Adolph Barreau came up with the idea of forming an artist agency, and that he could then say, oh, I'm selling this stuff to the different publishers, Shade Publishing or Donenfeld. You don't have to worry about bankruptcy. I'll be good for it, I promise you. And so that worked. So Majestic Art Studio was started by Barreau, kind of as a way to protect the artists in a way, but also to protect Donenfeld, because they needed to keep getting more guys to work for them. So this was another one of his things, Real Story Book Frolics. And here's the oddball thing. This is the original artwork by Adolph Barreau for this cover. And George Hagenauer, are you here? No, but he would know best if there's, because I'm not sure there is ever an original by Adolph Barreau for the pulp spices at all. I'm not sure I've ever seen one. But this is an actual original by Adolph Barreau, and it's available. Fred Taraba has it. He had it in Chicago. And there's his email address if you want to call him up and buy it. So it's kind of cool. There's a black artist did it. It's in a pulp magazine. And this is 1930. He actually appears, you know, in the whole history of early Golden Age comics. So this is years before. In 1933, organized crime or whatever decided that Harry Donenfeld had to become the owner of Police Gazette, which was a weekly publication that had been started in 1845. So it was really, really old fashioned, and it had gone completely into bankruptcy, so they got it for nothing, and the distributors owned it anyway. And so they tapped Donenfeld to take it over and to hold on to it. And so he asked Adolph Barreau to be the art director. And up until that time, the newspaper was printed on pink newspaper, and it was distributed to mainly barbershops and stuff. It would usually have pictures of like a woman in a, you know, like a sexy swimming suit or something like that, you know, which in those days came down to the ankles practically. Barreau redesigned the front page, and as you can see, that it's got the fan dance by Sally Rand. And she's top, her chest is exposed. So this was really never done before. And they weren't busted for it or anything. And within a year, the newspaper was doing fantastic. And so Barrow, as a man who had studied advertising, knows that, you know, sex sells. Inside the newspaper, oddly enough, Barrow included a comic strip that he wrote and drew called, quote, "The Saucy Misadventures of a Broadway Chorus Girl Named Flossie Flip." This is the first instance of Barrow convincing Donenfeld that it's important to include a comic strip in his publications to stimulate circulation. And sure enough, after a year, they resold it to an investor who kept it until the mid-1950s. So they did good, like he kept it going and sort of like fixing up an old home by putting in a swimming pool and then flipping it for a lot of money. When they decided that, you know, making something spicy was actually a good recipe for pumping up anything, they came up with the idea in 1934 of doing these spicy line of pulps, and they put out these things that are called ash can editions, so that they could then send a copy to the Library of Congress and say, this is our title, we have a copyright on it, we're going to go to press with it. And you could actually do that and not produce the magazine, but you could still sort of register the copyright. And these came out later, but there's a spicy detective, spicy mystery, spicy adventure, and they John Gunnison reprinted all of them a few years back for collectors, and all the art is by Adolph Barrow. Inside of Spicy Detective Stories was Sally the Sleuth in November 1934. So one of the things, I don't know if everyone knows this or not, but there's like a regular comic page with like six panels, and but it's eight pages, so you're flipping and flipping and flipping. So it's an actual like comic section kind of inside of it. Somewhat bizarre, I suppose, is the fact that this is before there actually were comic books. Isn't that cool? So the only comic books that existed were that they would take like the famous Dick Tracy or something that had run, you know, the previous year, and they would package it together and make a magazine of all the like Sunday pages or whatever. And so those were reprinted, but they weren't actual new comic books, where it was actually like buying a premium for your favorite comic strip rather than a unique item called a comic book. And so it's just interesting that Adolph Barrow kind of invented it. So there was, you know, it's not yet a comic book, it's a pulp magazine, but it has eight pages of comics in it. And before that, it didn't really exist. And as Mike Chomko pointed out, there was a ton of their different titles that were made in all the different magazines. I don't want to bore you with all the same names, Olga Mesmer and everything, but one of them was called Vera Ray, and that was kind of cute because that's Vera Marie Barrow, was his wife. In 1934, he then formed the idea of making comics for other pulp magazines. And it was proved later on that Paul Sampleiner was supplying the money for Ned Pines to produce the thrilling pulps also. And so oddly enough, or whatever, the Majestic Art Studio was making eight-page comic strips, eight pages of comics that were also in Thrilling Western and Thrilling Adventures in 1934. And Ace Jordan was drawn by Max Plasted for Thrilling Adventures, and Six Gun Sandy was drawn by Harold Detje for Thrilling Western. In 1935, Barrow created the comic strip The Enchanted Stone, and this appeared in newspapers throughout the country in something called the George Matthew Adams Syndicate. He had about 8 or 10 comic strips that were in the syndicate, and if magazine newspapers chose to subscribe, they could get all these different comics and run them in their newspapers. And that, of the 8 or 9 other artists that were in the George Matthew Adams Syndicate, they were all Majestic Art Studio artists. So again, it really looks like Adolph Barreau was kind of behind the first comic shop and was creating what would look a lot like a comic syndicate, which is something everybody wanted to do because that's really where the big money was in all publishing, was in syndication. So this is a kind of history-making moment, February 1935, the first issue of New Fun Comics. It included The Magic Crystal by Adolph Barreau, as well as strips by several of the other artists that were in Majestic Art Studios. So it's, again, interesting that Barreau is right there. So whatever is finally figured out about this bizarre history, Barreau is clearly one of the innovative contributors to the formative years of comics. Now, most of the table of contents pages of Spicy Pulps have pen and ink drawings by Adolph Barreau that you might recognize. Thanks to the incredible popularity of Superman after 1938, Paul Sampleiner and Harry Donenfeld wanted to solidify their legal ownership of the company that would become DC Comics. So they moved the Majestic Art Studio from independent spaces into an office in their office space at 480 Lexington. And in, just over the years, it's interesting to note that Barreau was listed as editor-in-chief of Trojan Magazines. He was listed as co-owner of Trojan Comics. Trojan is Donenfeld's publishing name. Although the businesses were actually owned by Paul Sampleiner and with the titular head of Donenfeld. In 1952, when Trojan Comics declared bankruptcy, Barreau was listed as the owner. Supposedly, he was the owner of all this great stuff, but as soon as everything was over with, he was just went around looking for jobs, and he found a job over at Fawcett Publications and worked there for another 15 years as a lowly job doing as photo editor. He lived to be 85 years old. He died in 1985. Okay, on to the next guy. Harry L. Parkhurst is really an old artist because, you know, by the time he's doing these, he's in his 60s. So you can maybe see from the way that he draws the woman's face or the animal or something that it really has this a very ancient look to it. It's not at all the look of the Jazz Age or of the Great Depression era. So he's really kind of a throwback that was able to find work during the Depression working for the Spicies. Harry Lemon Parkhurst was born in Minneapolis in 1876. And when he was 17 years old, his family moved to Chicago where he was able to study at the Art Institute. After 5 years of study, he started to work as a line artist at newspapers. And in 1899, at the age of 23, he moved to New York and began to draw pen and ink stories for magazines like Harper's, Pearson's, McCall's, Munsey's, and Everybody's. In the 1920s, he was an advertising artist for Kodak, Goodyear Tires, and Colgate toothpaste. When the Great Depression sent the advertising world into hibernation, he began to work for the pulps, which were mostly funded by newsstand sales instead of advertising income. And he worked for lots of different publishers, but he's really most remembered for his work for the Spicies. And he worked for all the different Spicies, you know, every different Spicy title. And then the other Donenfeld pulps as well. In 1937, he drew this serialized comic strip, Murder for Exercise, that appeared in Spicy Detective. He also drew Dear Little Dude for Spicy Western. Dear Little Dude is a Sally the Sleuth, a beautiful little young girl whose clothing is torn off in Spicy Western Adventures. Here's an uncredited reuse of a Spicy Adventure cover by Parkhurst as the cover art for Bob Dylan's Knocked Out Loaded. I don't know if you guys have ever, if you're Dylan fans, but if you go look at his work, he's been doing paintings, and they really look great. He's really a good artist. It's bizarre, but I think he's inspired by pulp art, because a lot of them have a look and feel of, even the songs on this record really have this feeling of like bar fights and stuff like that. Parkhurst also had a significant career in Golden Age comic books. He drew for Trojan Comics, Fiction House, Dell Comics, and Fawcett Comics, where he worked under the pen name Harry Parks. In his later years, Parkhurst lost his eyesight and became a resident at the Burwood Home for the Blind in Huntington, New York, where he lived until his death in 1962 at the age of 86. So this is Delos Palmer. He's like, again, fairly old guy. He had a more classic way of painting for higher paying magazines, but when he appears in the pulps, this is the style that he uses, and it's kind of abbreviated, and it gives you the feeling that he's just got better things to do. So they're a little bit splashed out and not necessarily in a good way, but he often has really tiny little feet and little tiny hands for the women, microscopic noses that, you know, and then ugly, big, surly men attacking them. He's born in New York at a socially prominent dentist on Park Avenue, who had his dental office on the first floor, and the house lived upstairs. They had live-in cooks, maids, and butlers, and lots of kids. He went to a very prestigious private school in New York, and when he graduated, rather than go into Harvard to study law or something, he willfully wanted to go to the Art Students League. There he studied with a great painter, George Bellows, who was a famous American impressionist, who painted rough and tumble laborers, newsboys, and milkmaids in New York City. I get the feeling he might have fought with his family about that decision. After he graduated, he opened his own art studio, but really only got jobs painting pictures of his wealthy family friends. In the early 20s, he got some work illustrating stuff for Liberty Magazine and Saturday Evening Post. But when the market crashed in 1929, the only work he could find was through the owner of Liberty, was Bernard McFadden, and he produced Master Detective and True Detective. So he got work doing that. And McFadden's manager was a guy named Irving Mannheimer. And again, Mannheimer was another affiliate of Paul Sampleiner. So it was through Mannheimer that Delos Palmer then was offered work for the Spicy magazines. But you have to wonder, like, if he has this squabble with his father, and then he's doing these things for Spicy Pulps during the Depression. It sounds like he needed money rather than that. And then the fact that he lowered the quality of his work while he was doing them from his other work, which was more carefully painted. Anyway, as soon as the Great Depression started to equal out around 1938, Delos Palmer left doing all pulps and went back to doing portraiture. He lived until 1960, and he died of a heart attack at the age of 70. You see those tiny little fingers? That's the giveaway. This is William F. Fulton Soar. He was born in 1896 in Hackensack, New Jersey. He graduated from high school and joined the Army. He served overseas during the Great War. He was discharged in 1919 at the rank of sergeant, but he remained in France to study art at the Sorbonne in Paris. I would say, like John Newton Howitt, Howitt was an extremely skilled painter, and it didn't matter if he was working for Goodyear Tire or for the Spider magazine. He put the exact same amount of effort into everything he did. He never cheaped out. And so you could tell he's really good. And this guy's also, I think, in that same category. He's very talented. He's great, crazy compositions, good rendering, you know, meaningful expressions. He's really very, very good. And he never really cheaps out at all. He studied with Harvey Dunn in New York City. And he did lots of illustrations in Saturday Evening Post. He's also appeared in like Boy's Life. And he worked for practically all the pulps. But he did tons of work for Spicy Adventures, Spicy Detective, Spicy Mystery, Spicy Western. Also, you can always tell his work because he's got this kind of tough-looking guy in his work. Kind of looks a little bit like him. I don't know. What do you think the photograph looks like? Unfortunately, he died of a heart attack at the age of 42. He was shoveling snow in front of his sidewalk in expectation of a scheduled visit from the editor of the Saturday Evening Post. So you have to think, if he had just stayed with the Spices. His son said, "My dad was rather shy and contemplative soul, who was deeply concerned with spiritual things. He didn't really enjoy doing lurid pulp covers, but that was the market and he was good at it." Okay, so full disclosure, this is my father, Norman Blaine Saunders. He was born in 1907 in northernmost Minnesota. His father was a fur trapper and his mother was part Iroquois Indian. His dad was the game warden for the Chippewa Indian Reservation in the Lake of the Woods. So this is a cover he did in 1935 for Donenfeld. The thing I've always impressed with my father's work, just to be editorial, is that his compositions are completely, you can't say self-expressive. So lots and lots of artists, they do a composition and you can almost recognize their work by the composition. They're like, oh yeah, it's back with that, back with that. And Dad had this bizarre thing that was, he had learned in art school called dynamic energy. And he would take the piece of paper and work it up into a grid and then a diamond and then diamonds within diamonds. And it looks like he was making like some sort of op art or something. And then as he would make more of these cross markings, he would then, in his words, start to see a composition within this thing. And he would say, well, this could be a leg, this could be an arm, and this could be... And then he would work up a kind of a cartoon based on that. And then he would hire models to pose in the positions that would make something more plausible. And you can sort of see it in this. This is a completely bizarre composition, but it's not happenstance. It's totally worked out ahead of time, and it's kind of, the word for it is formal. So it's like a formal way of making compositions. Anyway, something bizarre about him. He studied art through a correspondence school that was based in Minneapolis. And in 1927, he went to work as a staff artist at Fawcett Publications outside of Minneapolis in Robbinsdale, Minnesota. And his co-workers were Alan Anderson, Ralph Carlson, Al Allard, Carl Barks, Carl Buettner, Otto Sokolow, and George Rosen, and there were lots of great artists working there. In 1934, he left Minneapolis and moved to New York City to seek his fortune as a freelance artist. He studied for 3 years with Harvey Dunn. Harry Donenfeld and William Fawcett, Captain Billy of Captain Billy's Whiz Bang, they hated each other because Captain Billy sort of dominated the girly market in about 1928. And that was when Donenfeld was trying to be the king of the girly market. And so they despised each other. And you may know from your comic book history that Donenfeld put Fawcett out of business by suing them over Superman versus Captain Marvel. And so it's kind of funny that when Donenfeld stopped doing the Spicy Pulps, that Barrow would go over and work for Fawcett's was kind of amazing. you know, just a weird thing. I've always think there's something weird about Dad's women too that is unusual compared to the women that appear in other pulp magazines. They just seem a little more empowered in a world in which violence is around them rather than completely looking like damsels in distress. I don't quite understand why or why. But anyway, almost no one else was ever doing that in the spicy world. Anyway, Fawcett and Donenfeld, they hated each other. So when Dad worked for Donenfeld, he signed his work Blaine, which was his middle name. They did also for Donenfeld Saucy Stories and Spicy Mystery and Prison Life Stories. But one of the strange things for me was that Dad would always say that he did the mystery adventure pulps for Donenfeld and he did the saucy movie tales for Donenfeld. And I was always, "Jay, Dad, that's weird because they're not published by Donenfeld. Why do you say that?" And he goes, I don't know, but I delivered them to Donenfeld's office. I remember the name of the secretary and did the whole story about it. So it's one of those weird mysteries I've never been able to track down, but the actual publisher of those magazines, Mystery Adventure and the Saucies, is Nebulous. So they change so-called titular heads maybe 3 or 4 times in 2 years or so, or 3 years. So something funny is going on. I don't know what it is. But, you know, Lincoln Hoffman is listed often as the publisher, but oddly enough, Harold Hersey was listed as a publisher, but then, oddly enough, Harold Hersey's wife, Merle Hersey, was also listed as the publisher of Snappy Stories by Donenfeld. So there's some strange crossover going on, which I've never been able to identify, but the point being, why am I showing my father's work for the Spicies thing, is that that's what Dad always said anyway, and he's a really good artist, so he had an impact on the field. He kept working in pulps until 1960, I think was his last one. And he did 867 total unique covers, which is, you know, among the highest numbers by any artist. He went on to do comic books, paperbacks, men's adventure magazines, and trading cards like Mars Attacks and Wacky Packs. He died at the age of 82 in 1989. Here's Hugh J. Ward, Hugh Joseph Ward, born 1909 in Philadelphia. His father was a mailman. He was one of 7 kids in an Irish Catholic family. And he's the artist I think we all most love in terms of Spicies because it's just so many great iconic covers and he really nailed it every single time. There's no such thing as a bad piece by him. And he was just unbelievable and had a wonderful abbreviated way of painting, which is a little bit like Haddon Sunbloom, the guy that did all the beautiful Coca-Cola and pinup type paintings. He took classes at the Philadelphia School of Industrial Art, where his favorite teacher was Thornton Oakley, who was a student of Howard Pyle. Another student of Pyle's was N.C. Wyeth, who was in Thornton Oakley's class with him. And N.C. Wyeth came to Thornton Oakley's class and gave seminars to the young Hugh H.J. Ward. And Ward later said that that was the man who most inspired him to be a great artist. And you can see in some of his later works that there's a definite influence. He started out working as a cartoonist at the Philadelphia Inquirer, where he mastered drawings of cute little pinup girls. One of the pupils with him in the class was the pinup artist herself in the future, Zoe Mozart. And in order to pay her own funding, she was a nude model at the school, but studied painting and then had a career doing pinups of herself from the mirror, and then later even became a model for other artists as well. And this is her actually modeling for H.J. Ward. I really love this cover. There's something so gentle about that, the tummy press with that thumb. Isn't this a lovely painting? This was just discovered a couple of weeks ago in an attic in New England. They called me up The painting's now available. It will be sold in 7 days from now at Heritage, so go see how much you have in the piggy bank. Isn't that lovely? In this painting, you can see actually the guy I keep talking about, Harry Donenfeld, that's him in the upper right corner. He's laughing as the brunette and the blonde fight. And the brunette is H.J. Ward's wife, and the blonde is his old model, I mean his previous model. And Donenfeld wanted him to keep using the blonde, and the wife said no. And so that's, from then on, he used his wife as the model. I don't know if she was so happy about it, but. So he painted great, wonderful, wonderful junk and all over the place. And he was drafted in World War II and sent to boot camp. And he began to experience ill health. And it was determined at the boot camp that he actually had advanced lung cancer. And so he died at the age of only 25 in an army camp hospital in 1945. This guy is a real, I was raised with him as my uncle practically, so I really love this guy. He's got a wonderful way of painting. He was brought in after Alan Anderson. He was brought in after H.J. Ward was drafted. And he's just as sweet as the paintings he does. He worked for Fawcett's as a cartoonist, and so, again, you might detect, looking at them, that these function really well as just a black and white drawing of a cute incident, you know? And so he's like inventing a cute incident and then painting it in. He was born in 1908 in Minneapolis of Swedish ancestry. He studied again at the same correspondence school my dad studied with. And then he also went to work at Fawcett Publications in 1928. A year after my dad did, and they became best friends. And he moved to New York in 1940, and he painted for all the pulps, really. But he became pretty much the top guy after Ward was gone at the Spices. In 1944, Alan Anderson was drafted and sent to the Navy training camp where he instructed in recruits in graphic art techniques that were needed for shipboard communications. After the war, he worked for Ziff Davis Comics, doing a lot of nice covers for them. And he left the business in 1955 and moved to Woodstock, New York, where he worked as a sign painter for the rest of his life. He died at the age, total poverty, at the age of 87 in 1995. Right, this is the last artist we're looking at. It's Joe Zaccoli. He had a bizarre thing after Alan Anderson got drafted. Donenfeld took like two dozen of H.J. Ward's paintings, gave them to Joe Zaccoli, and said, "See what you can do with these." And so he would, if the guy was, you know, bareheaded, he'd put it like a sombrero on him. And if he was wearing a red coat, he'd make it a blue coat. If he was hitting a girl with a blackjack, he'd put a pistol in his hand instead. And so they were pretty okay. A lot of people would look at him and go, "Oh, it's not Ward's best, you know, but it's good. It's a Ward painting." And it looked like a Ward painting, but it was very, very cheesy sort of thing. This is his actual painting technique. So after a while, they said, "Well, okay, why don't you just make some paintings?" And he's not really a very good painter. It was a cartoonist, much more. And eventually, he started doing the airbrush covers. I don't know, but you'll see some in a few minutes. So Joe Zaccoli was born in New York in 1913. His father was a barber at the famous Waldorf Astoria Hotel, where Harry Donenfeld liked to get a daily shave sitting next to his friend Frank Costello. After Joe Zaccoli finished high school in 1931, he went to the Pratt Institute and was a major in the engineering department, but he took some art classes and then transferred over to the art department, and he studied there with Frederick Blakeslee. Now, Craig Poole has some really nice Frederick Blakeslee paintings that he just recently acquired that you might check out at his table. If you have a table, Craig?
I have a table, but I don't have the art.
Well, maybe you got pictures you can show him on the phone.
The art's too at the restoration.
And he also studied with Harold Winfield Scott and Rudolf Belarski. So there's some really great pulp teachers going on over there. Joe Zaccoli graduated in 1934, and he asked his father to put in a good word with him, with Donenfeld, and to tell Adolf Barreau to hire him. So Joe Zaccoli drew Polly of the Plains, a erotic cartoon written by Adolf Barreau and was published in Spicy Mystery. And he drew lots and lots of story illustrations, but also then began to do covers. And these are his airbrush covers, which are just more graphic. And then these are like an airbrush version of a painting by H.J. Ward, a completely new approach of redoing an old one in a kind of modern look. And in a way, it's interesting that it parallels at this time the paperbacks were going from genuine pulpy looking covers to sort of graphic-y looking pulp covers. And so it's kind of just mimicking the paperback look. As he kept working at Donenfeld's magazines in the Spicy Lines, he was eventually listed as art director. And then he went on to work as an illustrator and art director in men's magazines, Sir, Escape to Adventure, Man to Man, and Action. He eventually became a really high-paid airbrush artist doing retouch work in color photo advertising. I don't know if you are old enough to remember this, but there was a famous ad that ran for years and years for Cool cigarettes, and it showed a pack of Cool cigarettes and a waterfall splashing all around it. And that's his famous, completely made an airbrush by Joe Zaccoli. So he actually made a lot of money as a retouch artist, like tons. He died at the age of 68 in 1981, and that's the end. So thank you for your interest.
You've been listening to Pulp Tales, fascinating stories of the pulp magazines and the creative minds that brought them to life. Brought to you by The Pulp Net. Learn more about the pulp magazines through articles, blogs, bibliographies, links, over 100 episodes of this podcast, and much more at The Pulp Net. Your link to the pulp magazines for almost 30 years. Online at thepulp.net. Subscribe to Pulp Tales on your favorite podcast platform or listen to us on the web at thepulp.net. If you enjoy our content, please like us or leave us a review. And tell your fellow pulp fans about Pulp Tales. Thank you for listening and keep reading the pulps. Pulp Tales is copyright 2024 by William P. Lampkin.